Versa Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting officials look for terrorism suspect. Moroccan authorities say Belgium has formally requested help in tracking a key suspect in the Paris massacres. A statement from Rabat says Belgium's king has asked Morocco's king for cooperation in finding Salah Abdeslam. Abdeslam has avoided arrest since crossing into Belgium from Paris hours after the November 13th terrorist attacks. Brussels, meanwhile, remains on lockdown, and police there press forward with a search for terrorist suspects. Belgian Prime Minister Charles Michel says the danger of attacks remains.
I can confirm that the threat for an attack is imminent and serious, and we want to ask our population to stay calm.
Late Monday, the U.S. State Department issued a worldwide travel alert warning Americans that Islamic State extremists and other terrorist organizations continue planning attacks in multiple regions. Also, U.S. President Barack Obama welcomes his French counterpart, François Hollande, to the White House Tuesday. British Prime Minister David Cameron offered France new assistance Monday for its airstrikes against Islamic State insurgents in Syria. He said he would ask the British Parliament later in the week for approval to join the fight against the jihadists.
How such action would be one element of a comprehensive and long-term strategy to defeat ISIL, in parallel with a major international effort to bring an end to the war in Syria.
In a visit to Paris, the British leader told French President François Hollande that French jet fighters could use a British airbase in Cyprus. The United States has imposed sanctions on four Burundians it says have contributed to the turmoil in the Central African country. President Barack Obama took action against the four men in an executive order issued Monday. This is VOA News. Eurozone finance ministers have approved a $2.1 billion bailout for Greece. The move follows Greece's acceptance last week of key economic reforms. New austerity measures include higher taxes on wine and road use, as well as more limited protection for distressed mortgage holders. The government is racing to complete a bailout-supported recapitalization of its troubled banks before the end of 2015 and still faces a long list of more painful measures that include an overhaul of the national pension system. A Palestinian attacker stabbed two Israelis at a gas station on the edge of the West Bank on Monday. One of the two Israelis has died. The Palestinian was shot and killed by authorities. Earlier, Israeli police in Jerusalem shot and killed one Palestinian teenager and wounded another after the two stabbed an elderly man with scissors. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced tighter controls on Palestinian vehicles in the West Bank and an increase in the number of bypass roads, creating separate routes for Palestinians and Israelis. Russian President Vladimir Putin met with Iran's supreme leader Monday after arriving in Tehran on a one-day trip. He is in the city to attend a summit of gas-exporting countries. Mr. Putin met with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. He is also expected to meet with Iran's president. Mali began 3 days of mourning Monday for the victims of Friday's hotel attack that killed 19 people. Neighboring Senegal, Mauritania, and Guinea are also observing mourning periods. Malian authorities are searching for at least three suspects they believe are connected to the attack. A police official said the investigators are following several leads in the case. At least 100 bodies have been recovered, and rescue workers in northern Myanmar are pulling more bodies from the rubble 2 days after a landslide near a jade mine. Officials say at least 100 people are still missing. A new poll shows the level of trust among Americans for their own government is at among the lowest levels in the past half century. According to a Pew Research Center survey released Monday, only 19% of Americans trust the government always or most of the time. This is in stark contrast to just 15 years ago when 60% of Americans said they trusted the government. A mere 20% described government-run programs as well-run. The survey found Americans view elected officials as dishonest and selfish compared to typical Americans. 74% said elected officials act in their personal interest rather than in the country's interest. 80% of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents said they wanted a smaller government with fewer services compared to 31% of Democrats. In Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa. From the Voice of America, I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Tuesday, November 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Some Burundians welcome U.S. sanctions on certain individuals who threaten Burundian peace.
It's good because it's another step in pressure on the people who are committing crimes against their own citizens. It's a way of isolating them again and showing the country and the whole world that they have no moral ability to continue to be in the position they are in.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the banned independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. Nigerian truck drivers go on strike to protest treatment by Cameroonian authorities. Pope Francis travels to Africa in a day's time, but will he challenge homophobia in Uganda? And South Sudan troops begin withdrawal from Juba.
We will proceed to do what we think can be done as a government to show our people, as promised by our president, that we must implement this peace agreement because our people need peace.
Barnaba Morau Benjamin is South Sudan's foreign minister. Zimbabwe introduces a new land tax for resettled black farmers. And we will take a look at the multi-ethnic Paris neighborhood traumatized by terrorist attacks. Those stories plus Mark Olman's Sports and Our Listener of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Burundian journalist says that U.S. sanctions imposed on certain Burundian individuals are a way of showing those committing human rights violations in the country that they have no moral authority to continue to commit crimes against their own people. President Barack Obama on Monday imposed sanctions on four Burundians who, he said, have contributed to ongoing turmoil in the country. The U.S. sanctions include visa restrictions and freezing of the assets of the men involved. Innocent Muhozi, general manager of the banned independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network, says the sanctions may not be enough to change the behavior of the affected individuals because they do not usually travel to the United States or Europe. Nevertheless, Muhozi said the sanctions show that the Burundian people, that the affected individuals have no legitimacy.
It's good because it's another step in pressure on the people who are committing crimes against their own citizens. It's a way of isolating them again and showing the country and the whole world that they have no moral ability to continue to be in the position they are in and that they are using to commit crimes. It's good news for the victims. But we also have to notice that it's not enough to make them change their opinion because such kind of people, they don't care about traveling to the United States or Europe. Generally, there is a kind of people that are looking to other directions. But it's good to do such kind of things because at least in the eyes of the Burundian people, it means that these people have no legitimacy, that they are not recognized by no one.
Part of the sanctions will be to freeze the assets of the individuals involved. You are saying that travel restrictions is symbolic. What about assets freeze?
They are aware about such kind of decisions, so I think they took some decision to make sure that they cannot be affected by such kind of measure.
These sanctions by the United States are coming also on the heel of the African Union, the European Union, also imposing sanctions. What do you think? Is the government in Bujumbura, is its back against the wall?
Yeah, for sure the back is against the wall. But the whole problem is that these people seem not realizing what kind of situation that they are finding themselves. It is as if they don't care about nothing from outside or from inside that is different from their own view. They have their back against the wall, but they behave as if they don't care about that. The good thing is also that inside the country, that means for all those who are hesitating, maybe who are still supporting them, it's a message to tell them that they should take the distance from such kind of people because it's obviously it's clear that they have no future at all, political future.
What do you make of the news coming out of Burundi that the Interior Ministry Monday provisionally shut down the activities of the main civil society groups, which it said have been leading the movement against President Pierre Nkurunziza's bid for a third term?
They're just formalizing what is going on since months. You know, all those main organizations are almost prohibited from any activity. Those who are taking care of prisoners are not allowed, like a Prudence, anymore to go and visit prisoners. The president of this association, they attempted to kill him. They killed his son, they killed his son-in-law. Even himself got three or four bullets in his body and still under treatment in Belgium. most of the leaders of those associations are out of the country because they were running after them to kill them. So it's just a formalization of a situation that is there since months.
Innocent Muhozi is the general manager of the banned independent Renaissance Radio and Television Network of Burundi. He was speaking with me from Kigali in neighboring Rwanda. South Sudan's foreign minister has again said his government is committed to the implementation of the peace agreement signed last August between rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar and the Juba government led by President Salva Kiir. Barnaba Morau Benjamin says South Sudanese and the international community want peace. This comes as South Sudan announced on Monday that its forces have begun withdrawing from the capital, Juba, in line with the August 26th agreement. But Foreign Minister Benjamin says now is the time for the international community to make good on its promise to provide the necessary logistical support for the implementation of the peace agreement.
As you know, when President Salva Kiir Mayardit signed on the 26th of August the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan, he immediately declared a permanent ceasefire. And soon after that, he instructed the army commanders to start the relocation of the SPLA troops to 25 kilometers. And today, of course, the process has started in Juba, where the army headquarters has started to move the government troops to the located areas. President Salva, as he said much clearly, we are committed to the implementation of this peace agreement. And we are expecting the members of the SPLMIO in opposition and the former detainees to send their advance teams. The government has been ready since that day we signed. So if there are any delays, it is not on the Republic of South Sudan. We will proceed to do what we think can be done as a government to show our people, as promised by our president, that we must implement this peace agreement because our people need peace.
Mr. Minister, it seems that according to the agreement, the withdrawal should have begun and it should end by this week. Now, do you think your forces will be able to withdraw before the deadline, which is supposed to happen this week?
Well, that's why we say the delay, there is the timetable which is set according to the agreement. But because of the delays on the side of the SPLMIO and former detainees, they have not. That's why we think we should not be waiting. So if there are any delays, it is not on the Republic of South Sudan government. That would be the responsibility of the IDAD as well as the SPLMIO and former detainees.
When we last talked, your government was talking about the need for international support to the peace process. Yes. Is that support forthcoming and are you satisfied?
There is a lot to be desired. And I'm glad you asked this question. We really need support. For example, the relocation of our troops now to the areas. We will need some tents, we need some logistical support in terms of water points, in terms of tents for accommodation, some clinic, at least for some health service, you know. And then these are things we thought that the international community, the UN system and everybody who has been pushing for peace, we are not seeing them coming forward.
There was supposed to be an IGA summit. We hear that that has been postponed. What happened?
IGAD has been postponed as a result of the request of some of the IGAD leaders. For example, President Uhuru is doing the visit of Pope on the 25, 26, even 27. So he is busy preparing for the Pope's visit. And then Pope proceeds to Uganda for President Museveni, which is on the 27th, 28th, and 29th. So these heads of state will not be able to make it. That's why the IGAD chairperson, which is Ethiopia, foreign minister Ethiopia, because of the request of those leaders, that they will not be able to come at the day 24. So that is the main reason.
Barnaba Morau Benjamin, South Sudan's foreign minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Juba. Today is Tuesday, November 24th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Hundreds of trucks plying the transnational highway from Bamenda, Cameroon, to Enugu, Nigeria, are parked in Cameroon by drivers protesting what they call illegal harassment and extortion by Cameroon authorities. The driver says several of their leaders have been arrested. Moki Edwin Kizika reports from Yaoundé.
Tambe Eno, an official of the truck drivers' union, says some of their members were arrested while protesting what he called regular harassment by Cameroon's military, which he says asks them to pay up to $500 per truck as overloading charges when they do not have any weighing instruments. He says their trucks have been grounded because of this.
We are here for 1 week, standing here. Stress, 18 people are locked in the cell. Because when this thing happened on Wednesday last week, we were here till Friday. On Monday, our union president, all of us gathered here in Manfi. We went to the GO's office. We were singing song. We need peace. We need peace. Release our trucks. Release our trucks. The gendarmes now came and took our president. All of us, they carry everybody to the cell.
But Peter Tiende, the most senior government official in Manyu, in southwestern Cameroon, says the drivers were arrested because they tried to seize his office.
They actually invaded the office with the intention of taking over the office. In fact, they blocked all the ways into my office when I was out for a meeting. That is why some of them were arrested. We had about 50 persons and we asked them to go away. Those who went away were not arrested. Those who remained had the intention of actually obstructing this office from functioning. And that is why they were arrested.
Business has been slowed in the area through which Cameroon supplies Nigeria with food and farm produce, and Nigeria supplies Cameroon with basic commodities and dresses. The $423 million African Development Bank-funded road is 95% complete. Officials in Cameroon authorized its use before it is fully complete because the area was difficult, at times impossible to access without the new road. But drivers, in the absence of weighing stations, overloaded their trucks, and some Cameroon road protection officials collect bribes. The road is part of the Trans-African Highway, conceived 30 years ago as a transcontinental link from Lagos, Nigeria, on the Atlantic Ocean to Mombasa, Kenya, on the Indian Ocean. The highway will eventually stretch 6,300 kilometers. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Zimbabwe is introducing a new land tax for resettled black farmers, many of whom are already struggling. Some have been teaming up with white commercial farmers displaced more than a decade ago by the government's controversial land reform program. Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare.
The government says it will start charging black farmers who have benefited from Zimbabwe's land reform program between $3 and $10 a hectare per year in January 2016. The government is looking for revenue amid a seemingly sinking economy. The move is not worth because the land tax was one of the reasons that nationalists like President Robert Mugabe started the War of Liberation in the 1960s. Under Zimbabwe's land reform program, which began in year 2000, the government confiscated thousands of white-owned commercial farms and redistributed the land to black farmers. Mr. Mugabe said it was aimed at correcting colonial imbalances. But because they lacked financial capital and equipment, the newly resettled farmers have struggled with the demands of commercial farming. To help themselves, many have started partnering with displaced white commercial farmers, employing them as land managers or consultants. Douglas Mombeshora, Zimbabwe's lands and resettlement minister, says this is illegal.
To this we say no. While we understand that as government, we have not been able to fully support our farmers and financial institutions are not keen to lend money to them, we don't see subleasing as a solution. Government has agreed to joint ventures, partnerships and contract farming, provided the farmers bring their applications to the minister for approval.
He says those applications will not be approved if one of the partners is a former white commercial farmer. Still, the arrangements have continued to spread since about 2009. The Commercial Farmers Union of Zimbabwe, which represents 6,000 farmers displaced from their land told VOA the government is not responding to their request for authorization to farm. Critics of the land reform program say the police was meant to punish the farmers who were supporting the political opposition. Detractors blame the land reform program for perennial food shortages. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Pope Francis embarks this week on an Africa tour that will take him to the Central African Republic, Kenya, and Uganda. Gay rights activists say they are hoping the Pope will bring a message of tolerance when he visits the continent where gays have faced violence and discrimination. Lisbeth Pollard reports from Kampala, Uganda, one country where same-sex acts are illegal.
Catholics make up nearly half of Uganda's Christian population and hold considerable sway within a number of communities. Pope Francis's upcoming trip to Uganda has many wondering if he will address the issue of widespread and sometimes violent homophobia. The Pope once said that if somebody is gay and searches for the Lord in goodwill, who is he to judge? Commenting as part of a response to report of gay clergy members in the Vatican. Joanne Benora, a devout Catholic, says she approves of the Pope's stance.
Jesus never condemned anybody, mm-hmm. So that's what he's also doing. He's representing the image of Jesus Christ on earth. So when homosexuals come up and they tell us we are homosexuals and want to be accepted, we shall accept them, being that they are also created in the image of God.
Benora, however, says she supported Uganda's now-annulled Anti-Homosexuality Act of 2014, which condemned gays to harsh jail sentences for same-sex acts.
When they come to the church, they will not be condemned. When they come to the community in Uganda, they will be condemned mm-hmm. by other people, because the law of the country will take over.
Many Ugandans, like Benora, say they feel there's no contradiction between supporting religious doctrine that doesn't condemn LGBT citizens and at the same time supporting laws which send such individuals to jail. They say this is because Uganda's local culture must be respected. Last year, a case against two Ugandan men accused of committing homosexual acts was dismissed for lack of evidence. One of those men, Jackson Mukasa, was recently quoted as saying he would like the Pope to at least make people know that being gay is not a curse. Even though the 2014 measure was annulled, homosexuality is still illegal under laws dating back to the colonial era. Joseph Natua is the parish secretary at Our Lady of Africa Catholic Church. He also supported the Anti-Homosexuality Act, but says he believes the church should be more tolerant of gays.
I believe Pope Francis, when his message might be about not us condemning the homosexuals, mm-hmm. but us trying to help them, because some of them, you get some of them who are just trained, mm-hmm. who are recruited yeah. mm-hmm. when you are still young, so and we're judging them harshly. So yeah, I think his message is going to be more into how to help them and accommodate them within our community.
Most parishioners say they want the Pope to tackle what they say are more pressing issues in Uganda, such as peaceful elections, healthcare, and education. There has been no word about whether the Pope will speak about gays during his visit. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
As residents of Saint-Denis, France, recovers from a traumatic police raid on terrorists last week, they are quick to point out that the two people killed were not from the neighborhood. Some residents say this suburb of Paris's biggest asset is its multi-ethnic community, but others say they are frustrated with the continuous struggle faced by some of the youth. Mariama Diallo reports.
Assiatou Diallo has been living in Saint-Denis for 23 years and says she never expected such a raid to happen in her neighborhood. She says Saint-Denis is a big city with more than 100,000 people and many nationalities that have always lived well together. She says there are mosques and churches, but the members have always respected each other. She says the neighborhood's diversity is what enriches its residents, but that, like many suburbs, problems with youth unemployment and delinquency exist. She says authorities have made some efforts, but it's hard, and that they should definitely focus on finding work for the youth and other ways to improve their lives. Isabel Ijie is the director of PPV 93, a local organization that helps in improving the quality of life for the youth and their integration in day-to-day social activities. She says what happened last week was traumatic, especially to those who live nearby or witnessed the Saint-Denis raid.
Ije
says most of her employees are still traumatized and have not returned to work since the raid. She says it could have happened anywhere because no place is immune.
Le quartier du centre-ville de Saint-Denis, c'est un quartier.
She says Saint-Denis is historic, with the basilica that is the burial place of many French kings. It also has the Stade de France, and the neighborhood in the center is very vibrant, with people coming from all corners of the world and with different economic backgrounds. She says this is Saint-Denis' biggest asset. EJ says her organization has been around for at least 20 years. Journalist Aliou Goloko says he's not surprised that the raid took place in Saint-Denis.
Because we all know that Saint-Denis is, you know, a city with a lot of problems. You have so many people coming from abroad particularly. They are all French but with foreign background.
Goloko says French authorities have to do a better job in letting the public know that the people of Saint-Denis are not terrorists. Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Washington.
Time now for Daybreak Africa. Sports here is Marco Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Tuesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa sports news, we begin with football. South Sudan beat Djibouti 2-0 as guest side Malawi pipped Sudan 2-1 in Group C action at the Council of East and Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Awasa, some 270 kilometers south of the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa, on Monday. Today, Tuesday, Uganda face Zanzibar as Rwanda engage Tanzania mainland in Awasa. Staying in Ethiopia, Sudan Football Association head Jafar Muntazim was elected the new SECAFA president in Addis Ababa on Saturday. He takes over from Tanzanian Leodega Tenga, who steps down after 2 4-year terms in office. Long-serving Kenyan Nicholas Musonye continues as SECAFA secretary general. Meanwhile, the adjudicatory chamber of FIFA's Independent Ethics Committee head Hans Joachim Eckhart revealed in Zurich, Switzerland on Monday that they have opened a formal adjudicatory process against FIFA President Sepp Blatter and FIFA Vice President Michel Platini. Eckhart says they are studying the final report submitted by the Ethics Committee's investigatory chamber and will announce their decision in both cases next month. Turning to golf, defending champions Uganda amassed 18.6 points to win the East Africa Golf Challenge in Kigali, Rwanda on Sunday. Kenya was second with 17.5 points. Rwanda was third with 14.5 points, followed by Tanzania with 7 points and Ethiopia with 2.5 points. Ethiopia will host next year's contest. Finally, in athletics, Kenyan Edwin Chesarek is the first athlete to win the America's National Collegiate Athletics Association NCAA cross-country championships for the third consecutive year. A student at the University of Oregon, Chesarek completed the 10-kilometer course in 28 minutes and 46 seconds. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. The United States has imposed sanctions on 4 Burundians, it says, have contributed to ongoing turmoil in the Central African country. That is it for this Tuesday, November 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with our engineer Jamie Cook, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa. Making his first trip to the continent, the pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa.